As we wrap up 2024, the pop culture experts at Consequence are back with our annual report, celebrating the year's best in music and entertainment. And this time, we're bringing you Something Extra, a brand new podcast series exclusively on Amazon Music. Get inside access with interviews featuring the year's biggest artists, actors, and filmmakers, plus discussions with the Consequence team on our best of the year lists. You can tune in with Amazon Music Unlimited, now free for 3 months. For a limited time, get 3 months of Amazon Music Unlimited free by visiting tryamazonmusic.com/COS. You'll get over 100 million songs in stunning HD sound, on demand and ad-free, plus top ad-free podcasts, including the Consequence Annual Report podcast. Even better, every Amazon Music Unlimited subscriber now gets one free audiobook from Audible each month. So celebrate the best of 2024 with Consequence's Annual Report all December at consequence.net. And don't miss the companion podcast by signing up for 3 free months of Amazon Music Unlimited at tryamazonmusic.com/COS or clicking the link in the show description. That's tryamazonmusic.com/COS. Consequence Podcast Network.
This is Graham Nash from The Hollies and from Crosby, Stills & Nash, and then, of course, Young. Right now, you're listening to my story behind Teach Your Children, and you're listening to it right now on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. This week's episode features my interview with legendary musician, artist, and activist, and two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, Graham Nash, whose seven-plus decade career kicked off in the 1960s with the famous UK group The Hollies. Nash later moved to Los Angeles at the end of that decade, where he, together with other legendary musicians like Joni Mitchell, birthed the famous Laurel Canyon Sound and Scene. That's where Nash met musicians David Crosby and Stephen Stills at a dinner party, found harmonic magic as he joined the two in song, and immediately formed Crosby, Stills, and Nash, later joined by Neil Young, releasing several classic tracks in their short time together. Amongst those Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young tracks, one of their most iconic is Nash's Teach Your Children, a song with a message as relevant today as it was when it was first released in 1970. Nash discusses how the song came to be, how it rocketed up the charts, and how the band itself derailed its progress in the wake of the Kent State tragedy, when it shifted its focus to Neil Young's classic song, Ohio. Graham candidly reflects on it all, together with other seminal moments in his fascinating life, in this wide-ranging interview. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's timeless 1970 track, Teach Your Children, with the great artist and activist, Graham Nash. The thing about your songs, Graham, is that they're as timely today, to me at least. Tell me a little bit about your approach to songwriting, because the songs really resonate today with everything that's all the forces around us. So they're timeless in that sense. So help me understand your process.
My process is this. I have to feel something first. I have to feel very deeply about a subject. Then I research it and I write about it. I want to write songs that are timeless. I want to write songs that are so relevant today, but in 20 years will still be relevant. And with my songs, Chicago and Military Madness and Immigration Man, they're all songs that if they were written today and were popular today, would be completely expected by me. I try to write timeless songs.
And is that process effortless for you? Is it work? How does that feel within you?
One could call it work. It's not work to me. It's what I do, you know. And I love what I do. I'm a musician. I'm a songwriter, and I want to express myself. I have been an American citizen for over 50 years. I wanted to vote. I wanted to take part in the society. I wanted to express my opinion about America, good or bad.
That's why the songs are so relevant to, you know, what we see in America right now and in the world in general. Tell me a little bit, Graham, about growing up and just your musical journey, how you got to the point of starting The Hollies, a little bit about your just what got you into music and how you you connected the dots or made the dots happen to that point?
Alan Clark and I were at a school called Ardsall School. We would sing in harmony at the Lord's Prayer every morning. I always took the high harmony. I don't know why, but I always did. And he always took the melody. So we were singing a lot together. And then, of course, we were experiencing the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly. And we wanted to sound like them. We would try and copy them, you know, and then try to forget it and bring it out your way. But that's how I started making music. Alan and I formed the Hollies in December of 1962. A little later that month, we were playing a lunchtime show at the Cavern in Liverpool. In those days, they had a lunch hour show from 12 to 1, so that all the kids that didn't want to, you know, to stay at work would go down to the Cavern. Yeah. And after our show at the Cavern, this man came up to us. His name was Ron Richards, and he said that he was from EMI, and would the Hollies consider going down to EMI in London and auditioning to make a record? And of course, yes, absolutely. And Ron Richards was the producer of the Hollies for all the time that I was with them, which was about 6 years, from 62 to 68, actually.
So when you were first playing there, you were in your late teens, right?
Mm-hmm.
You were still in school.
No, I had to leave school at about 15 to be able to get a job and help my family out financially. But my mother and father always encouraged me they understood and believed my passion for music. On a Sunday evening, when you're supposed to be going to bed and getting up for school the next day, I was always listening to Radio Luxembourg, which was a station from Luxembourg in Europe. And when the weather permitted, you could hear the signal quite plainly. And I was always listening to the American Top 40. At school, I was always drawing guitars, and I was always drawing drum sets, and I was always fantasizing about getting an electric guitar. My mother and father recognized my passion for music and did not dissuade me from my path.
And so when you were playing at first with the Hollies, when you started the band and you were playing in the Tavern, like you were said, and you were discovered there by EMI, was that a venue that was known as a place for discovery, or was that just serendipity?
Don't forget who was discovered at the Cavern before us, the Beatles.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Yeah. So I guess a few people were discovered at the Cavern. So
yes, you, yes, they were.
There you go. That's when the Beatles had their original drummer, I think. And was that pre-Ringo Starr?
They swapped drummers, a few months later. Yeah.
Okay. And so that all happens. You're with the Hollies, and the Hollies is a very successful band. But my understanding is then you traveled to the U.S., and then that evolved into what became you leaving the band and starting something entirely different. So tell us about that part of the journey.
I played my last show with the Hollies at the London Palladium in London in late 68. I had met Joni Mitchell a year earlier, and I wanted to spend some time with her. So I called her up, and she wanted to spend time with me. So I went from the last show at the Hollies, and the very next day came to America on December the 10th. When I got to, I got in a yellow cab at LAX and went to Laurel Canyon, went to Lookout Mountain, and pulled into the driving, into the parking lot. And I heard other voices there, and that wasn't great for me. I wanted to just spend time with Johnny. But it was David and Stephen, and they were having dinner. I'd already met David, so I kind of knew him when he came to England with the Birds. But I'd never met Stephen. They were there having dinner with Johnny. They smoked a big one right after dinner. I joined them. And David said to Stephen, he said, "Hey, play Willie that song that that we were rehearsing." You see, the Buffalo Springfield had broken up, and David had been thrown out of the Byrds, so they were trying to get like a duo thing together, an Everly Brothers type thing, and they did this song called "You Don't Have to Cry," which was on the first record, of course, and it was beautiful. And they got to the end, and I said, "Stephen, that's a fantastic song. Do me a favor, just play it for me one more time." And so they did. They shrugged and they sang it one more time. They got to the end of the second time, and I said, "Okay, I'm pretty good at what I do. I've been a harmony singer all my life. I love this song. I've learned the words. I know how David is breathing. I know how Stephen is holding on to notes at the end." I said, "Do me a favor, I'm not crazy. Play it one more time." 45 seconds into the third time that they sang it, we had to stop and laugh because we had never heard this kind of harmony before. Anyone can sing the same notes that me and David and Stephen sing. You can't sound like us when we put our three voices into one.
I tell you, that's quite a dinner party you had there.
Okay, yeah, almost the same as the Johnny Cash dinner party.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And so you come together here and you have this magical moment. And is there an immediate decision
Yes.
that let's make this formal?
We had to. We had no, I mean, we're musicians. We know what's good. We know what's bad. This was
Yeah.
not only good, but it was fantastic. What we
Yeah.
had discovered in the first 45 seconds of this song was unbelievable to all three of us and to Joni too. And so I realized at that point that I would have to go back to England. I would have to give up my band, a very successful band, as you said, and come and live in America and follow this sound because I'm a musician. And that's what I did.
That's when you decided to leave the Hollies?
That's the band I had to leave. I had no choice. That sound was just too powerful to me, and to David, and to Stephen, and as I said, to Joni.
And we're going to get into Teach Your Children, which was from the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album. So Neil Young joined. And tell me how that happened, and then we'll segue into the song itself from 1970s Deja Vu.
We were in the Wally Heider studio in San Francisco. There were three studios there. We were in A, the Grateful Dead were in B, and the Jefferson Airplane were in C. We hadn't
Simultaneously, that was all happening at the same time.
at the very same time, yes. I mean, Stephen and I had done a very, very easy acoustic track of Teach Your Children, with me on acoustic and Stephen on acoustic and Dallas Taylor, our drummer, on tambourine. When we got to the part where there's supposed to be a solo, both Stephen and Neil said, "You know what? We've played a lot of electric guitar on this album already. What can we do to make it different?" Crosby came up and he said, "Hey, I've heard that my friend Jerry Garcia is just learning to play the pedal steel and he's in the next studio." I said, "Okay." We made a rough two track of the song. I said to Davey, "Take this into Garcia's studio, play it for him, see if he likes it enough to bring his pedal steel into our studio and play." He did. He loved the song. He came in, he set up. We hit the red light. He played one track. We got to the end and I said, "That's unbelievable." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You searching your way through a song you've only just heard once is amazing to me." And he said, "Well, I made a couple of mistakes. Can I do a second track?" I said, "Yes, absolutely, out of respect as a musician. Of course you can do a second track, but I'm never going to use it." He said,
Yeah.
"What?" And I said, "No, you don't. You've got to understand, Jerry. You searching your way through this song was brilliant." We did, in fact, take the two mistakes, very slight ones, out of his second track, but I used the first track that he played, and he turned it into a big hit.
Yeah, look, there's another kind of lightning in a bottle moment, right? That happens so much and the idea to not make it perfect, to allow the humanity that comes from the imperfection
Exactly.
Right? Adds the kind of the special sauce.
Exactly.
And it
was very special sauce, I must admit.
Yes, it was. It was. So do you recall the first moment where that particular song, whether it was the melody or a lyric, entered your head?
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I do indeed. And it was in England. I had started teaching children because I realized that if we didn't teach our children a better way of dealing with humanity, humanity itself was in trouble. And so I had the first couple of verses and the chorus, and I finished it when I moved to America. I played it for Stephen. He looked at me and he said, "You know what? That's a pretty good song. Don't ever play it like that again." I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "No, you sound like Henry VIII. No, 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 no. This is how it should go." And he put that beautiful picking pattern with Stephen's right hand that he's so famous for. And between that and Jerry Garcia's intro and playing it on that record, that was it. And Neil hasn't played or sung a note on Teacher Children or Our House, as a matter of fact.
The first kernel was it lyrics that came out, or was there a slight melody? I know you changed it ultimately the way that you described it, but do you recall in your process, is it one way or the other typically, or not at all?
It was typical of me. I had a melody, and what I have in my mind is right now probably over 50 little melodies that I've written in my mind. And I have the equivalent amount of lyrics that I have. Once I find a lyric that fits a melody, I'm off writing. And then I need to, you know, research what I want to write about. And that's what happens. And that's what happened with Teacher Children. I had the melody and a few of the lyrics already established in my mind before I got to America.
The lyrics and the story of Teacher Children, you said that it's a reflection of the times. So what was the context at that particular moment that you were referring to in Teacher Children?
The fact that children, regardless of nationality, are children all over the world. And we have a lot to learn from them. And we have a lot to teach them also, because we need to teach them kindness. We need to teach them empathy. We need to teach them manners. You know, and that's what I tried to do with my children. I didn't have, my children then, but it became even clearer to me when I had children of my own.
Was there a particular event that was happening at the time that stirred you into thinking that, or was it just the general context of life in the UK at the time?
With most of my songs, it's just life that happens to me. That's why my new album is called Now. It's just me reflecting on what's going on politically and what's going on romantically with me in my life.
What was the feeling like in the studio amongst you all? And was there any sense of pressure? Explain just what the overall vibe was like when you were recording this, and whether you as a musician, having come together, this is now your second album together with CSNY, if you felt any pressure.
No, not at all. Not at all. Here's what went on. When I first started recording with the Hollies, everybody down at EMI wore white smocks. The engineers, you couldn't touch the board. If I wanted more rhythm guitar, I would have to tell Ron Richards that I wanted more rhythm guitar, and that he would tell the engineer, who would then bring the fader up on the rhythm guitar. Once you sell millions of plastic pieces, which is what the Hollies did, you had a certain power.
Yeah,
I didn't have to ask Ron Richards to bring the bass up. I could reach over to the board and bring it up myself. We never lost that power. So there were no record company people at the records. There were no musicians union people at our recording sessions. We kept everybody away so that we as musicians could concentrate on what we were doing. When Teacher Children was put out as a single record, it was going up the charts. It was already in the top 30. And then Ohio happened. David told me, he was up in the Bay Area with Neil at a house of a friend of ours. They were, spending a weekend together, just chilling. And he called me. I was in Los Angeles. He said, book the studio, book Halvorsen, who was our engineer, book the band, book tape, book it all. I said, absolutely. Why? He said, well, I just showed Neil the cover of the magazine with the slain student from Kent State on. I saw him pick up his acoustic guitar, walk out into the woods where the house was, and come back an hour later with this song called Ohio. We have to record it. They came down the next day. I'd already booked the studio and the engineer, et cetera, et cetera. We recorded Ohio in three takes. We wow. recorded a B-side called Find the Cost of Freedom in three takes. Ahmet Erdogan, who was our dear friend from the, who was at the session, we gave him the mix and we said, we want this out now. He said, wait a second, you have Teach Your Children going up the charts. What do you mean you want it out now? We said, look, it's way more important that people understand what the government is doing in their name than us having another hit record. Bring it out now. And the original 45 sleeve for Ohio was a picture of the Constitution of the United States with four bullet holes in it. Wow. We killed our own single, and we were absolutely delighted with doing that. Gotta get down to it. Soldiers
should have been done long ago. So when you were finished with all this, during these crazy times back then, how did you feel about that album? And then help me understand, you had the great success, all of you together, but it was a relatively short period of time that Crosby, Stills, and Nash were together, and then, you know, with Neil Young also. So walk me through that a little bit.
The very first Crosby, Stills, and Nash show without Neil was in 1977. Everything else before that was with Neil. We've always been like brothers, and like brothers, sometimes we argue, but most times we're on the same page. It's been an incredible journey. Since David passed, of course, that journey is over. Quite frankly, when David passed, you know, I had a choice. Do I think of the good times and the bad times, or do I just concentrate on the good times? And yeah. that's what I chose to do. I chose to concentrate on the music that David and I did and the good parts of the friendship. But with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, it's always very difficult. I mean, you know, to get a decision out of four people, four completely different people, right. is always difficult. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young have a new album coming out on October 25th, as a matter of fact. It's Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young live at the Fillmore East here in New York in 1969.
That'll be something that'll be really fun to listen to. But I can only imagine, look, you have four great musicians who have, as you said, four different, very different personas in many ways and styles, and to come together, the magic is there. But yeah, I mean, of course, everybody is self-willed and has their own ideas. So it's never easy in any kind of collective of any kind.
It's easy when we're making music.
Then, and I want to fast forward a little bit to this. Well, let me ask you this. That was 50 years ago when you recorded, over 50 years ago when you recorded that song, and you had written it before that. And it's the general question for all of your songs, but let's focus on that one. Does it surprise you at all that over 50 years later, what you wrote back then is still just iconic? People listen to it. It's a, you know, it's ongoing. It's ageless. Does that surprise you?
No, it was designed that way.
So even as a young lad, when you were writing this, you had that sensibility within you.
Absolutely. I mean, why buy something that's only popular for 10 minutes?
Well, I mean, look, it's a great way to approach it. And of course, not everybody does when they're writing their songs. And so that's what makes it special. And it's the humanity also that you talked about. Some of the little mistakes, some of the, you know, that comes through. Mm-hmm. I want to fast forward a little bit from that to in 2021. Well, you had a song called Dirty Little Secret that was recorded in the early 2000s. And then in 2021, there was an animated short film that was submitted to the Tribeca Film Festival. And that was a short film that was by Jeff Scher. I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name. But
it is.
So tell us a little bit about what was behind that. And what's the interesting tie-in is my understanding was that Jeff worked with you on Teach Your Children doing some kind of video project before that. Is that true?
Yes, it is. And here's what happened with Dirty Little Secrets. I wrote that song with my friend Russ Kunkel, who is obviously well known as a drummer, but he's a fine songwriter. And we wrote that 18 years ago. We were ahead of the game there because once I had heard that story, and I think it was from a CBS 60 Minutes piece many, many years ago. And I felt incredibly sad that it happened. And I wrote Dirty Little Secrets with Russ. It's still going on today.
I just want to say, Graham, just for a second there, so you can give people context. For those people out there who don't know what the context is for Dirty Little Secret that Graham is talking about, his song and then this animated short that we're talking about. Graham, can you just lay that out a little bit more?
In June, late May, the 31st of May and the 1st of June, in Greenwood, Oklahoma, it's right outside of Tulsa, you know, it's 10 minutes from Tulsa. And what happened is this. There was a young black kid elevator operator, and a white girl had gotten in, and there, you know, something happened, you know, and the white people took that as an excuse to try and get him out of jail and lynch him. And of course, he had a lot of defenders there because who knew what the real story was? And as a matter of fact, he was found not guilty about it. And it probably didn't go exactly as the white people thought it went. Anyway, they burned Greenwood to the ground. It was the Black Wall Street. It was a very successful society. About 1,200 buildings were burned to the ground, including churches, including schools, including hospitals. And about 300 Black Americans were killed that day. And that's the story of the race riots in Tulsa. It's called a race riot with the word riot at the end, because then the insurance companies don't have to pay anything because it was a riot. And it really wasn't. It was a massacre. And right now they're digging up the graves in the local graveyard there. Yeah. And they're thinking about reparations to the black people. Although with so many lives lost and so much property being destroyed, what is the value of the reparations, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, again, yet the Tulsa massacre of 1921. And so yet another example and a powerful one where Graham, you see the times, you in not just the times that you're living in, but bringing back moments that are overlooked conveniently, either intentionally or not intentionally by many, and then bringing them to the fore because those stories continue on. And that's where this gets back into the timeless aspects of your music. And like your recent album now, which is 2023, which everybody should check out. And Golden Idols is just one of the songs, but it's an example of some of that.
Yes, so, indeed.
Over the years, you've also been very pivotal in other ways to other artists, emerging artists. You've helped them emerge. Who are some examples of some musicians that and stories that may not be as familiar to people out there, but that were special to you, of artists that you felt were deserving of attention, and so you were able to bring life to their careers and elevate them?
In 1969, when I was in recording with David and Steven in Wally Hyder's studio in Los Angeles, we took a short break. I went to the next studio and I hear this man playing acoustic guitar and using his foot on a box as the bass drum. And it was beautiful. I went into him, I said, boy, that really sounds really great. And he said he was going to give up the business. He was, you know, he couldn't make it anymore, and he wanted to give it up. And I told him, absolutely not. You've got to keep going. Years later, I did a benefit at my kids' school, and there was a little band, a school band, and they were called Cara's Flowers. I said to my son, whatever happened to Cara's Flowers? And once again, he said, they can't make it. They're going to be doctors and dentists and stuff. And I said, look, take this money and take them into the studio and record some demos. Exactly a year later, they were number one as Maroon 5.
How about that? That's an amazing story. And Bill Withers is another great, that's one of the great artists that you brought to life.
Indeed.
I do want to go back because Laurel Canyon is also special to me, but it's such a powerful part of your overall story and lore. You mentioned it in the dinner party and living with Joni Mitchell, and that was part of the milieu. But what was the overall life like in Laurel Canyon? Because it is so legendary to people out there. But being in the center of it and being one of the central musicians who was part of that scene. So what was it like to be living in Laurel Canyon, and what made it so special at that time?
Laurel Canyon was a wonderful place for me. I came from England, which we shall say was gray. And I entered a world that was technicolor, and it was full of sunshine. It was full of music. It was full of beautiful women, and it was full of interesting drugs.
Yeah, it sounds like quite a wonderland at that time. And there's a Wonderland school up there, by the way, and right off.
Yes, there is. That's right.
So it was quite the wonderland at the time, for sure. And did you know, when you were with everybody there, did you feel like it was a center of the musical universe? Like, did it have that kind of sense about it, that there was something special going on, not just with you?
Yeah, not only was it fascinating for me as a musician, but it was very special. And we knew that it was a special time. It wasn't until much later that it became this myth, you know. But at the time, we always thought that it was a very special moment.
For you, as an artist who's multifaceted, what do you think of the music scene today? And are there any particular artists that stick out for you that you feel are exciting, new, and just meaningful to you?
Childish Gambino. With his video and his song "This Is America" is fabulous to me. I don't like a lot of the music that needs 20,000 dancers and people throwing food in slow motion. I don't like it all, but I do like real music.
And then of all the things that you've always been writing about the times and how your life and the times that you're in and the things that matter to you and trying to help influence for the better. And I want to read one of the quotes I read that you had said before that was really meaningful to me. I'm not sure where you said it, but this is what I have. All the things we stood for, that love is better than hatred, that peace is better than war, that we have to take care of our fellow human beings because that's all we have on this planet. Those things are still true today. I need to know that I brought something into the world that was positive and not negative, which I think is beautiful. So bringing that to life, I'm not sure when you said that, but what are the aspects of life that you're focusing on today?
I'm focusing on living. I'm focusing on trying to find beauty in the world. I'm focusing on my music and things that I love. I'm now 82 and a half. I have to really understand that I may be coming to the end of my life. I certainly hope I'll be around for a few more years. But now I have to take every moment and make it the best that I can. And that's what I focus on.
How do you feel about the state of the world today?
I'm not, I feel a lot better after the last month. Since Joe Biden quit the race and brought Kamala into it, I feel much more hopeful that America will take a turn for the best. Obviously, I think of what the world would be like, and particularly this country, if Trump gets reelected. I don't know what I would do with my life, but I will love this country and stay and fight.
It's hard to compare, but when you, the way you just describe things right now about how things are today, is it analogous to the way you felt back in 68, 69, 70 with all the tumult that was going on in the US?
We thought Richard Nixon was crazy, but this guy is something else. Trump is much more devious, he's much more cunning, he's much more negative, he's much more power conscious. This is a different world. But then we thought Richard Nixon and what he was doing was awful. But this is much different.
And believe me, I hear you. I'm completely with you on everything you said. I can't compare it to the context of 1968, 69, but I definitely understand. That's why some of the questions that I had, for sure.
Yes.
Including golden idols. That's why it speaks so much to me. And then just finally, Graham, you know, we talked about your recent album, 2023's album Now. We talked about your recent animated short film that was based on the Tulsa massacre. You're going to be touring, or you are touring, I believe, but you're going to be touring in the U.S. for the fall, winter time. How do you feel about touring at this point?
I can't wait. I just finished a 5-week tour. Every place that I played was completely sold out. The audience were ecstatic with what we were doing. I have 3 people playing with me who are just brilliant musicians. Zach Janikian on guitar and mandolin and electric guitar and saxophone. I have Adam Minkoff, who plays drums and plays bass and sings at the same time. and Todd Caldwell, my dear friend, on keyboards. He put this band together for me, and I'll be forever grateful for him. And quite frankly, I can't wait for this next tour.
Very exciting. Well, we look forward to seeing it. I didn't see it on the schedule, but I was hoping you were coming to Southern California. I don't know if LA or San Diego are on the map, but I certainly hope so.
I think they will be in the spring tour of 25.
Okay, good.
And hopefully we will have a new president.
Listen, Graham, I really respect you. I respect you as a musician, as I said, but I respect you just as a human being and everything that you stand for.
That was Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young telling the story behind his timeless song, Teach Your Children, whose gentle power is as relevant today as it was when it was first released over 5 decades ago. I'm your host, Peter Chadi with Deep Cuts Media. Join me each Monday for another episode of new interviews mixed with classic interviews of icons like Debbie Harry of Blondie, Rick Astley, and Boy George. Reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com if you want to add your own icons to this list. And make sure to like, follow, and share each episode and the show itself. And remember, you can always revisit all of my great 50-plus interviews in our show library. The artists are legendary, their stories are classic and timeless. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.